This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Earlier this year, we told you about the plight of a sea lion pup. Our senior producer, Christopher Intagliata, at home in California, came across a creature skittering across some coastal rocks. It was a baby sea lion. Perhaps it was part of a large increase in the number of sea lions stranded on strange shores along the West Coast the first 5 months of this year. Today, researchers published a paper in Science taking a look at a culprit, possible culprit behind these wandering sea lions. And joining me now to discuss this new research and other selected short subjects in Science is Lawrence Summer. She's science and environment reporter for KQED Public Radio in San Francisco. Welcome back, Lauren.
Hi, Ira.
So tell us about the sea lions. What could be going wrong with the sea lions?
Yeah, well, so we've had this record-breaking toxic algae bloom off the coast here for most of the summer. And it's the reason that you can't eat Dungeness crab that's been caught off California right now. These toxic algae are producing, you know, it's a neurotoxin, so people can get pretty sick if they eat seafood that has it. And yeah, the question's always been, what's the effect on marine life? And some of these sea lions show up on the beaches very disoriented. You know, they have seizures sometimes. And so what researchers did is they actually took some of these rescued animals and they put them through a series of tests, actually some mazes, to see what the neurological effects of this toxin have been.
Mm-hmm. And what did they discover?
Yeah, so, you know, these are very smart animals, and the mazes were not too complicated, but they had some kind of fish, right, as a reward in one location. And a healthy sea lion, you know, it's no problem for a sea lion to memorize a maze and find it over and over. But these sea lions that have been affected by the toxic algae, they had a really hard time remembering and finding where the fish are. And that's a big concern, right? These animals in the wild have to remember where food sources are.
And what was the culprit in the algae?
So the algae produced domoic acid. It's a neurotoxin that can kind of build up and, you know, in smaller organisms. And it's these larger organisms that are kind of eating all these different seafood, and it builds up in their brains, unfortunately.
You also bring us a couple of fresh stories off the presses from the fall meeting of the American Geophysical Union in San Francisco. Let's talk about this interesting story of lake temperatures, rising lake temperatures around the world.
Yeah, this was a concerning study. You know, what the researchers did is they looked at more than 200 lakes around the world, and they found that lakes are warming faster than the land or the ocean is, at a faster rate. And this is even more pronounced for lakes at higher latitudes. And, you know, it's a concern for the same reason we were just talking about off the Pacific. Warmer waters can produce algae blooms, which sometimes produce toxins, and they also kind of deplete the oxygen in a lake, which is obviously bad news for the organisms that are living in it.
Wow, and so it's lake. Big, small. We don't hear much about them. You know, we always think of the rising oceans, but the heating up lakes. Wow, interesting.
Especially, I mean, the Great Lakes were some of at the top of the list, especially Lake Superior. And the reason for that is they're losing their ice cover sooner than they normally are. And as you might imagine, the ice cover kind of acts as an insulator and prevents some of this warming from happening.
Yeah, that's interesting. Also at the AGU, you learned that West Coast fog might be clouded with mercury. Doesn't sound
Yeah, this was
healthy.
Kind of a mystery. Yeah, it was a mystery that these researchers were trying to solve. You know, why does our fog here have mercury in it? And they've kind of worked on a theory where the mercury, you know, it's coming from smokestacks. It's coming from power plants, and it's getting into the ocean. But the rain here doesn't have the same levels of mercury. And what they figured out is that the mercury from the ocean gets up into the fog, and the fog is actually kind of acidic. And so it's taking that form of mercury and turning it into a form that's really easily absorbed by animals, by organisms. And so that's what they were finding. As this fog kind of comes on the coast, it's actually getting into the food chain.
So is it dangerous? Well, you're out in San Francisco. You're in the fog. You're wearing
a
mask
worried.
Or something?
If you're in San Francisco, don't fret. It's not dangerous for you to stand in the fog. But what happens is kind of as it gets deposited on the land, it kind of gets absorbed in the food chain and then concentrates, you know, as bigger animals eat smaller animals.
Right.
And what they were finding is they've tested wolf spiders. They have very high levels of mercury at certain times of year on the coast. And the same with mountain lions, actually.
Wow. So when you add mercury to the food chain, everything's going to get affected going up. That eats it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Last up, if people thought that double rainbows are impressive, and they are if you see them, you have a story about an all-red rainbow. I don't think I have ever seen and all. I've seen full circle rainbows, double rainbows, but never an all red rainbow. Tell us about that.
Yeah, pretty unique. I'm guessing there aren't a lot of people out there that have seen it. This was a researcher that, you know, has completely remade the classification system for rainbows, right? Most of us, okay, we don't have any idea what that is. But essentially, he's made 12 categories of rainbows because he was saying today's system just leaves out these really unique rainbows, like this all red rainbow. And the reason that rainbow happens is it's at sunrise or sunset when the sun is very, very, very low in the atmosphere. And because it has to travel through so much atmosphere, it's really only the red wavelengths that are making it. And those get bent when they go into a water droplet, right? And that's when we see the rainbow. But yeah, the all red rainbow is so interesting to look at.
Could it be that the rest of the rainbow is there, but it's below the horizon, so to speak? You know, it just doesn't,
yeah,
it doesn't rise up high enough to see the rest of it, because I think red is on top, right?
Yeah. It's that these wavelengths are getting filtered out, but people might actually see other kinds of rainbows that have fewer colors, right? We know it's kind of the Roy G. Biv, right? Red, orange, yellow, et cetera. But there are some rainbows that just have red, orange, and yellow. There are some that are missing other colors, you know, things that I've never really thought about before, but they're changing all the time. That's kind of the amazing thing.
Because you do need a critical angle. It's something like 41 degrees or something like that. That's why the sun has to be low in the sky for you to get that angle that bounces off the raindrops. I've done a lot of research on rainbows, so it's kind of one of my hobbies. Lauren, thank you very much for taking time to be with us today.
Thanks so much.
Lauren Sommer is a science and environment reporter for KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, California. Now it's time to play Good Thing, Bad Thing. Because every story has a flip side. If, as the saying goes, necessity is the mother of invention, then climate change is one mother of a problem. In the face of hotter temperatures and more extreme weather conditions, communities around the world are adapting to what it is, often literally, sometimes going to become a new landscape where they're living. Here with some examples of innovation in the face of climate change is Virginia Hughes. She's the science editor at BuzzFeed News, based in New York. She's with us today in our New York studio.
Hi, Ira.
I love that sweatshirt, BuzzFeed on.
Thanks.
Let's talk about the good thing, the bad thing.
Yeah. So as you know, it's pretty hard to find a good story in the climate change narrative. And I think this is all in the context of, well, if you have to put an optimistic spin on this. So with that caveat, it is pretty remarkable looking at some of the dozens of cities around the world that have already experienced some pretty significant changes, mostly related to flooding, warmer temperatures, and pretty extreme weather events, and have come up with some clever ways to adapt. So just to name a few, in Bangladesh, the monsoon season is pretty bad and keeps thousands of kids out of school every year. Mm-hmm. And as the sea level rises, this is going to get worse. So a nonprofit group has built about 20 floating schools, which are these small boats that hold maybe a couple dozen kids. And they're sitting at desks, and the boats have solar panels on them that would power computers and lights inside the boats. And this group has also made some floating health clinics and floating libraries. So that's one way, put all of your important infrastructure on the water.
Yeah, let it float along with you.
Right. Another cool example comes from a village in northern India. And this area of the world historically has gotten its water from low-lying glaciers in the Himalayas. But because of increasing temperatures, those glaciers are disappearing. And so actually starting in 1987, there was a pretty clever civil engineer who came up with a way to make artificial glaciers. So how it works is, during the winter season, engineers divert river water into these long and meandering canals. And these canals eventually empty into a big valley. So because they're all curving and kind of meandering, it slows down the water flow enough that when the water lands in the valley, it freezes. And if you repeat this, you end up with these layers of ice and an artificial glacier. And it's pretty cheap. I think the biggest one he made was only $2,000 and could provide water for 700 people in a village.
Wow.
So
people are thinking, yeah.
Yeah. Another one, a kind of a high-tech example, comes from a mega city, Rio de Janeiro. a few years ago, it was struck with a huge rainstorm, triggering floods and mudslides and killing hundreds of people. And so that triggered a citywide response to this kind of flooding, which included a $14 million operations center built by IBM. And it looks something like a war room. It's this huge room with dozens of screens all on one wall. And the screens display real-time data from weather stations, subway stations, streets, and dozens of city agencies. And so the idea is that city engineers can track traffic problems, energy outages, flooding, disasters, and hopefully mount a coordinated response.
Well, I guess the bad news about all of this is that you have to do all of this. This is going to be the new normal, right?
Yeah, exactly. It's kind of a shame that these adaptations had to be made. And, you know, according to scientific consensus, it was potentially, some of it was preventable if we had curbed our use of fossil fuels more than we have. As you guys reported, the historic agreement that was signed last week in Paris, nearly 200 countries have now agreed to try to keep the global temperature increase to below 2 degrees Celsius. But the trouble is, as actually Christy Ashwanden, a great science writer, wrote this week in 538, this would have been a fantastic agreement if it had been done in 1995. But it's 20 years later now, and beyond the time, it comes with no binding rules. So it's really unclear whether it will ever happen, this 2 degree max.
As they say, we are borrowing the future from
our
grandchildren. Yeah. Well, thank you very much. Interesting stuff.
Thanks.
Virginia Hughes, she's a science editor for BuzzFeed News based here in New York. We're going to take a break, and when we come back, we're going to look at how we can archive the entire internet. There's an organization that's doing that. Brewster Kahle is going to be with us. Every single URL. Wow. How do they do that? And maybe you can find your old messages in there. We'll talk to Brewster when we get back after this break. Stay with us. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. If you drive to the northern tip of San Francisco, you're going to pass rows and rows of painted Victorian homes. And as you get closer to Presidio Park, you're going to pass a corner building that, well, just seems out of place, like it might have been lifted from the Acropolis in Greece. And while the architecture may seem out of place, the building, though, fits right into the spirit of Silicon Valley. It's the headquarters of the Internet Archive, an organization that has a small goal of preserving and archiving the entire internet, web pages, photos, blogs, videos, everything. Brewster Kahle, digital librarian and founder of the Internet Archive, gave producer Alexa Lim a tour.
The Internet Archive is in San Francisco in a beautiful building, and it was a Christian Science church. The reason why we bought this building is because it matched our logo, which was sort of the pillars of Alexandria. And the Internet Archive is part of the vision of the Internet to build the Library of Alexandria version 2. So this is a scanning center of the Internet Archive. Here we're digitizing 8 and 16 millimeter film. There's book scanning going on over there. So we hit the record button on the World Wide Web in 1996 and take a snapshot of every website and every web page on every website. So we started by collecting the World Wide Web, but there's other media types that also aren't being collected, like old video games, the old Apple II, Commodore, Atari. There are these communities that have gone and put these online towards keeping older digital materials alive. We're now in the great room of the Internet Archive, the old church part. We actually still have the pews. These blinking machines are actually servers of the Internet Archive themselves. Every time a light blinks on this, it's somebody either uploading something or downloading something from the Internet Archive. We get between 2 and 3 million users every day, so people want old stuff. Technologically, it's completely doable, right? To actually go and collect these materials. The question is how do you do it and who's supposed to do it? What we want is the wackiness and the wildness of all the people participating in the big conversation that is the Internet.
That was wacky and wild. Brewster Kahle himself, digital librarian and founder of the Internet Archive in San Francisco. And you can see photos from that tour on our website at sciencefriday.com/internetarchive. So is it possible to preserve the entire internet? And who should be in charge of doing it? Brewster Kahle is here to talk about it, along with Abby Smith Rumsey, a historian and author of the forthcoming book, When We Are No More, How Digital Memory is Shaping Our Future. She's also based in San Francisco. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you.
Great to be here.
Brewster, it's good to have you. You know, we were looking at our archives, and we found when you joined us back in 1993, and you were on an historic show that was the first national radio show to be broadcast live on the internet, on that edition of Science Friday.
Yes.
Our show was...
And we even talked about climate change at that time.
We did.
We did, if you listen to the recording.
It's amazing. And that show was digitized. We sent it out to Xerox PARC, and they digitized it out there and sent it over the internet where probably both people could listen to it on their PCs at that time. So when did the idea strike you? I know you're an internet pioneer. When did it strike you that, we need to record and archive everything on the internet?
Well, actually, it's the whole reason that I got involved in trying to get the internet publishing system going in the 1980s. But by the time the early 90s came around, I'd built a company to help publishing happen on the open internet. And the reason to do that was to make it so that you could actually build a library. Only if it's open, only if there's free exchange of information on an open system like the internet, could we build the library. So 1996 is when we started the Internet Archive to try to archive the whole web.
Yeah,
and then the whole internet.
Wow. So you created a web crawler called the Wayback Machine to take a snapshot of every website. I love that name because we all know where it comes from. How does that actually work? How do you archive it?
We started out by going and making a robot that basically started with the Yahoo directory, and it would just take all of the web pages, and it would basically be a dumb robot that clicked every link on every page and recorded what it saw. Then if it found new links, it added it to the list. And it would just go and go and go and go and go. And then we'd start it again after 2 months. But we've gotten a little bit more mature now. Actually, there are now 1,000 librarians in 400 institutions that are building subject collection. And the persnickety librarians are wonderful because they want to make sure that we have everything exactly right. So we started with robots, but now it's a combination of robots plus librarians.
Well, I want to tell our listeners, if they have an important website that they'd like to get to, or you have a question about how we can archive the internet, our number 844-724-8255. You can also tweet us at SciFry, SCIFRI. Abby, when people are taking pictures, they usually delete the bad ones. And as an archivist, are we throwing out potentially good information? You know, back in the day, I used to talk to other archivists about paper photography when we used to do that, and they lamented the idea that people no longer keep their bad photos. They just delete them off their cell phones or cameras, and it's sometimes the bad photos contain useful information.
Well, I agree that sometimes bad photos contain useful information, even if it's not very flattering. But you must know a very different set of people than I do, because I don't know anybody who deletes anything from their cell phone. I think this is one of the issues that we face, is the scale of possible duplication. It makes editing not worth it, because we think we can save everything. So this becomes a problem for deciding what to highlight or how to search for the things that are truly significant, as opposed to just an accidentally photographed redundant picture.
Are you saying that you don't want all of that stuff that people are saving?
No, in the sense that not everything is equally important. There are two ways of thinking about it, and this is what makes the digital so different from the analog things that are in hard copy. In the digital, it's very easy to be able to record and then to send something out on the web. You don't really have to think about it. So you don't have any filters in place. Mm-hmm. So things of, you know, very disparate quality and also intention, something that could be intended to be just short or something that could want to last for a very long time, they live in the same space. And for archivists and both robots and librarians, such as what Brewster has, it's difficult for them to wade through so much material to find the things that are truly significant. But I will say that We're used to thinking of selecting materials and putting them into print or recording because they have some kind of long-term or at least near-term value. That's not true of a lot of the stuff on the net, which is, or the web, I should say, which is like a conversation or a bulletin board. But I also think that we need to change the way we think about the value of content per se, because most of the content on the web now won't be read by human beings. They'll be read by machines, and at a scale which human beings have a hard time imagining. Machines can see different patterns in large data sets than humans can, so it could be that we actually do want to save all those bad photos because they will have some significance to a machine that runs some algorithm that's invented in 50 years.
Yeah. Brewster, are we going to be able to read all the stuff that we save in formats that we're used to, you know, JPEG, whatever, MOV files, text? Do we have to keep up with that, don't we?
We do. Basically, not only do people become changing what they're interested in, whether the file formats are even viewable or not. We've had to go and take the movies that have been uploaded to the archive.org, which you can just hit the upload button and upload movies. We've had to transcode those 6 times over the last 15 years to just make it so that now people want to see them on their iPhones or whatever it is. And we have to just keep on it. So the format conversion is really a big issue. Flash is now already becoming basically obsolete, and a lot of web pages use them. So there's we in the archival community of we used to just be able to kind of, I don't know, sit around, wait for people to die, and then they just give us the stuff. No more. We have to be out there all the time, not only gathering the stuff, but keeping it in formats and keeping it relevant.
So are you looking for people to go to your website and say, here, just take my stuff, take my photos?
Yes, absolutely. Just go to archive.org and hit the upload button.
What about all the tweets? Can you archive all the tweets? I mean, the billions of tweets that are going on.
Twitter and Facebook, it's the web has shifted. It used to be a very open world where basically you invited crawlers because that's how you got searched and found. But now we're starting to get more and more closed areas to the web, whether it's Facebook, which doesn't allow crawling at all, or at least us to crawl. There's also issues with Twitter where they license that material. So we get the things that are currently referenced. But trying to get a comprehensive collection is hard. They've given a copy to the Library of Congress, which actually is above and beyond what most commercial companies do. But it's still difficult to get to for researchers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Ira, you have to understand these are privately owned information assets, really. People don't think of things that they put on Facebook or Twitter as belonging to somebody else because they come from us. But in fact, they don't have ultimate control over this. And Brewster's right. We need more organizations that control information like Twitter, Apple, Google, to actually develop partnerships with public institutions like the Internet Archive or the Library of Congress so that they can be archived and made available to the public for the long term. Right now, most of these firms can do whatever they want ultimately with the data that they have, even though it may not be what they generate themselves. There's an agreement, which many users don't quite understand, between the user or the uploader and what the control is they have over that data long term.
Mm-hmm. Number 844-724-8255. Let's go to Kirkusville, Missouri. Hi, Alan. Alan, are you there?
I'm here.
Hi, go ahead.
Yeah, a few years ago, I found the limitation of the Wayback Machine. I always loved it, but and I really support the idea of it. But my favorite blog was something I would check in on every month or two and kind of read a bunch of entries all at once. And I went back to do that at one point, and it had totally disappeared, and I was wondering what happened to the blogger. So I went on the Wayback Machine, and it had been, like, no archived. Apparently, people, if they want to just disappear and take all their content away, they can click to not have it archived, and then it's really gone. And I don't understand why that's an option, because it kind of seems to defeat the whole idea that your host or your guest is expressing here.
Okay, let me ask Brewster about that.
I'm sorry we let you down. There's been some compromises. The question is how do you deal with some of the privacy aspects or even copyright aspects of the web, where some of the materials are not meant for the ages? And what we've done is made it so that people can retroactively take things out of the Wayback Machine. And so they could be actually in the Wayback Machine, and then they put a robot exclusion, or they write to us and say, look, that was the blog from when I was married and I don't want it up anymore, or whatever. And sometimes this is creating holes that they shouldn't be. It sounds like that's what you got caught in. But it's been a compromise to try to do a bend, not break approach towards how archival should we force other people to be, especially a younger generation that don't really understand that some of the things they're saying online are going to be there in 20 years.
Hmm. Here's a tweet in from iPolitical Global, who asks, how big is the archive in items and bytes?
The Internet Archive collects web pages at about 1 billion pages per week. So the web collection is about 450 billion web objects, pages or GIFs and JPEGs. So that's the database size, which is just freaking huge. The Library of Congress's number of books is 28 million. We collect that about, 6 hours in terms of the number of items. The total byte collection is 26 petabytes. It goes mega, giga, tera, peta. Is the next thing after terabytes. So 26 petabytes, and it's replicated in San Francisco as well as in Richmond, and a partial copy in Alexandria, Egypt, really, and Amsterdam. The idea is to try to, not repeat the Library of Alexandria problem this time around.
I'm Ira Flatow. This is Science Friday from PRI Public Radio International. Talking with Brewster Kahle and Abby Smith-Rumsey, about archiving the internet. Abby, you worked with the Library of Congress. How did they tackle web preservation? How did this differ from the traditional approach?
Well, it's been a challenge, and not just for the Library of Congress, but every library and archive that exists for paper and other things, just because the scale is so huge. Libraries and archives are used, as Brewster said, to receiving things essentially after the fact, when something has already been published, in which case a book has been through many, many filters. There's been a substantial, allocation of resources, money and time, in order to get something published. And it's almost inevitably deposited for copyright, and a company will actually deposit a copy of the book, a hard copy or a film, to the Copyright Office in the Library of Congress so that it can be preserved. I mean, they actually deposit it so that in case there's a court case, they actually have some evidence. But it means that the Library of Congress has been able to build this massive, literally unparalleled collection of the creativity of the American people, things that they have for copyright. And that's no longer operative in the digital realm. The copyright law for the digital age is so far behind what it needs to be for the analog world. It's not even comparable. And it's very difficult to understand how to reform copyright in the digital age in a way which accommodates and promotes the private practice, a private creation of content, but also to make an accommodation for the long-term, unassailable public interest in the access to these cultural assets over time. And so there really needs to be a kind of a handoff between the private creators or owners of content and something like the Library of Congress. Until that's in place, then most libraries and archives, they often will partner with, an institution like Brewster's, but in fact Brewster is unique. They will get somebody to do some web crawling for them of the segment of the web that they specifically collect. So a special collections that does labor history, for example, that used to collect ephemeral pamphlets will now actually use something provided by the Internet Archive called Archive-It, where they can actually direct a crawl to gather the kinds of materials that are the digital equivalents of handbills and flyers and propaganda, that kind of thing. So that's what institutions are doing, and they're trying to do it as best they can. But again, I'd say that the scale is something that's very difficult for people to understand. And the institutions that are used to doing this are largely in the public domain and inadequately funded to do that work.
Yeah, this is what we really call big data. We're going to take a break and come back and talk more and get more of your questions. Our phone number, 844-724-8255. You can also listen online. Go to our website at sciencefriday.com if you would like to listen from your desktop or your portable device. Talking with Brewster Kahle, Abby Smith-Rumsey. We'll be back after this break. Stay with us. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. We're talking this hour about archiving the internet and all that digital stuff we're creating. My guests, Brewster Kahle, digital librarian, founder of the Internet Archive, Abby Smith-Rumsey, an historian and author of the forthcoming book, When We Are No More, How Digital Memory is Shaping Our Future. Our number, 844-724-8255. Let's go to the phones. Let's go to Derek in New York. Hi, Derek.
Greetings and salutations.
Thank you.
Thanks for having me on. The issue I wanted to bring your attention is related to the presidential candidate, Governor Chris Christie of New Jersey. A couple months back, there was an indictment, and I think the first trial is perhaps started, maybe, on what they call Bridgegate, where the George Washington Bridge connecting New Jersey to New York, the most heavily trafficked bridge on the planet, was closed under the guise of a traffic study as political retribution for not endorsing the governor and his reelection campaign by a Democratic mayor. The indictments have bordered around the testimony of Christie's staff and Christie, and the hole in the investigation are missing, destroyed emails and tweets between his staff and his staff and Christie. WNYC New York affiliate.
You got to get me to a question because I'm running out of time here.
Can your archive find, identify, and produce the missing emails and tweets that were destroyed by his staff?
All right, let's ask that. Well, Brewster, can you do something like that?
Sorry, not going to be there for you. In general, it's actually probably not tweets. They're probably SMS messages that they did texting each other on their phones. And the Internet Archive has really started to do basically published works of humankind, things that were available to anybody without any restriction. So if it was on their website or if it were tweeted, we'd have a very likely, or YouTube's, things like that, we'd have a good chance of having it. But if it's private communications, in general, that's not the realm of libraries. Now, you can have archives, but they have to be sort of permissioned in. And we're starting to work with archives, but so I'm not going to help you on that one.
I imagine that the data must be growing exponentially. And
yes.
Are you going to run out of space? I imagine with all the servers there, you don't even have a heating bill, right? Because it's just the heat from the servers must take care of you in the wintertime.
Absolutely. We heat the building based on the servers. We're buying petabytes at a time. But luckily, the digital guys are doing really well towards continuing to have the disk drives get bigger and bigger and bigger. If that stops, which actually there's some indication that the hard drives are flattening out and actually may not get bigger, we're going to be a little bit in trouble. Fortunately, it only costs us a couple $1 million a year to just buy the new servers that are required. So you say, well, that's a lot of money, but not by big boy standards. Mm-hmm. So we could basically keep up.
Mm-hmm. So Ira, this is a very interesting question because, you know, there is a limit to how much we can put on physical formats, and the amount of information which is growing, particularly in the scientific realm, is really phenomenal. It's even hard to guesstimate. But there have been some very interesting, successful proofs of concept recently about writing human memory to DNA material. This has been done in Switzerland and in various university campuses and Microsoft in the United States. And so the hope is that we'd be able to keep far more information if we can inscribe it onto DNA. I know that sounds almost sci-fi-ish, and there will always be moral and ethical issues involved in dealing with anything having to do with inscription on, after all, what is, you know, the code for life.
Right.
But there, people are very aware of how dangerous all of this explosion of information is in terms of storage space.
Mm-hmm. Well, I want to thank both of you for taking time to be with us today. Brewster Kahle is digital librarian, founder of the Internet Archive. Abby Smith-Rumsey, an historian, author of the forthcoming book, When We Are No More, How Digital Memory is Shaping Our Future. Have a great holiday.
Thanks. Same to you.
Thank you very much.
Job seekers scanning usajobs.gov on Monday might have noticed an intriguing post. The position astronaut candidate, the employer, NASA. That's right. For the first time since 2011, you can apply to be a U.S. astronaut. The competition is going to be fierce. So last time NASA accepted astronaut applications, they got over 6,000 for just 8 slots. And there were so-called anthropometric requirements. Astronauts need to meet vision and height thresholds. You know, that spacesuit isn't one size fits all. And that's before you get to the proverbial right stuff. My next guest knows a thing or two about that, joining me to talk about what it takes to get to space and where our next astronaut class is headed is NASA Administrator Charles Bolden. And before heading up NASA, he was an astronaut, including piloting the Space Shuttle Discovery on the mission that put the Hubble Space Telescope into orbit. I'm very pleased to welcome Administrator Bolden back. Welcome back to Science Friday.
Ira, it's great to be back. As I told you before, I always love to have the opportunity to come on and be with you.
Well, thank you very much. Let's talk about the job offering that you have up there. What kind of experience qualifications do these new astronauts need?
Well, believe it or not, it's pretty straightforward. They have to have a bachelor's degree in a technical field, and that means anything like science, physical sciences, biological sciences, engineering, math. If they've already finished school and they're a doctor, they're eligible. If they happen to be a pilot, with an undergraduate degree, as long as they have 1,000 hours in high-performance jets, they're eligible. So pretty straightforward.
Yeah, but it's pretty narrow then, you know. A lot of experience.
Yeah, it gets narrow when you get to the selection process, and that's when we start looking for special things like a demonstrated ability to do a spacewalk. And since I never did a spacewalk and I've never been close to a spacesuit, I'm not exactly sure how we test that down at the Johnson Space Center. But you've also got to have demonstrate language capability, you know, language aptitude, which I did not have to do. And then you have to be able to demonstrate agility doing manipulating robotic apparatus. So I didn't have to do that either. I doubt if I could be selected.
I know some folks at Johnson. I think I can get you a tour down there if you're
I am hoping so.
You make a great pitch in this job posting. You say NASA's on a journey to Mars. Is that where NASA is headed now?
That is absolutely correct. That, most importantly, Ira, that's where this nation is headed. You know, NASA represents the civil space sector of the United States, and all of our nations, all of our partners look to us for leadership. And we've got any number of nations, up to 14, who helped us draft something called the Global Exploration Roadmap. But most of our international partners are right alongside us with a destination of Mars for humanity in the 2030s is our ultimate goal right now.
You know, I always ask this question whenever I talk to you, is do we have the money to get there?
You know, I am a happy camper today. We just got word that the House and Senate passed the 2016 Omnibus Authorization Act. NASA is the recipient of, or to be the recipient of, about $19.3 billion for our 2016 budget. That is significant funds that supports our plan with modest increase each year as we go out toward 2030 and increases for inflation. We have a plan at hand that will be funded with that kind of budget. We're not looking for Apollo era funding. We're looking for a steady increase in a growing economy. So, yeah, we're in good shape.
In fact, they gave you more money than you asked for, didn't it?
That's why I said I'm a happy camper. When you go out and you know, when my granddaughters come in and they say, we want this for Christmas, and I give them extra gifts, they're happy. I'm really happy today. Santa has already come to me.
Santa's come early. But that money is targeted for Mars missions, is it not?
There is some of it that's targeted for Mars missions. The Congress has done an incredible job. And I tell you, I cannot thank the members of the Appropriations Committee and the authorizing committees. Senator Nelson's been super. Senator Shelby, Senator Mikulski, Congressman Culberson, Congressman Honda. We owe it to all of them. It was a bipartisan effort. And they managed to cover all of the four major areas where NASA, mm-hmm. where NASA focuses: aeronautics, human spaceflight, science, and space technology, as well as plus up on our education program, our STEM education program. So I'm happy.
Earlier this month, NASA Chief of Human Spaceflight William Gerstenmayer said NASA was looking to move on from the International Space Station. He said, we're going to get out of ISS as quickly as we can. What does that mean for new astronauts? Are we not going to be training them for any space station work?
Or
are we
going? Yeah, well, Ira, what Bill meant was when he said as quickly as we can, he means we hope that we will be prepared to move out into the vicinity of the moon as our next area of routine operations for NASA leadership. If all continues to go well, we were fully funded for commercial crew with this budget, so we should have a capability here in a couple of years to launch American astronauts and our partners from the space coast of Florida once again, as we promised. That'll be a big deal. So we want to enable commercial entities and American industry to take over the primary responsibility for operating in low Earth orbit, and that will mean a follow-on to the current International Space Station. Which right now, it's probably going to run out of its useful life sometime in the next decade, because it's a machine, and machines break and wear out. So we want to see that replaced with industrial facilities and commercial facilities. But we've got to be ready to move out into what we call cislunar space, the vicinity around the moon, for about 10 years to finish up our preparation for sending humans to Mars in the 2030s.
So what you're saying to commercial industry is, we're leaving low Earth orbit to you guys. It's your playground now. We're moving out to an asteroid and Mars.
I wish I could say it that simply. What we're saying is, we're going to depend on American industry and entrepreneurs to provide primary transportation there. NASA will still need to use low Earth orbit, but I want to be able to lease or buy the service, you know, buy the laboratory space or whatever, and then bring them up eventually with us to cislunar space and then on to Mars. So that's the way we've been working cooperatively thus far. And so far it's working.
If Elon Musk or Jeff Bezos or any of the new rocket pioneers decide to go it alone, let's say they've talked about going out, would NASA provide astronauts for them in that kind of adventure?
No, NASA doesn't provide astronauts for non-government ventures. However, as I have told our international partners and our industry partners, when we get the Space Launch System and Orion operating and we're able to go to lunar orbit again, it has the power and the lift capability to carry not only NASA programs and projects, but our partners along with us. And I said, we will support and help anyone who wants to prepare a lander to go to the surface of the moon with one condition. I want to be able to put a NASA astronaut on the crew that goes down. So, you know, hopefully Jeff will continue to do what he's doing. He is doing an absolutely incredible job at Blue Origin. They shocked everybody and pleasantly surprised us when they did the actual vertical return and landing to a touchdown, safe cushion touchdown, coming back from the first actual suborbital flight into space, brought back both the first stage and the crew module.
Yeah, a little easier than landing on a rocking platform in the middle of the ocean, I think.
You know, SpaceX will do that. It's hard. It's hard to do any of that stuff, and that's what makes us so proud. You know, there is no competition between NASA and industry. The competition is among the industry partners of ours. Our job is to facilitate their success. And I hope that if you were to talk to Jeff Bezos or to Elon Musk, they would tell you that they have been successful to date in no small part due to the partnership and contributions of NASA. Mm-hmm. We want them to be successful. We need for them to be successful. And, you know, I want them to go as far as they can go. If they want to go it alone, fine. But if they need our help, that's our job, is to be here to help them.
Talking with NASA Administrator Charles Bolden on Science Friday from PRI Public Radio International. If you can tell Jeff to give us a call, we've been trying to reach him. Elon's been on a few times, but Jeff is a little shy of the phone. So
you know, that maybe I tell you what, I next time I talk to him, I'll mention it, and I'm certain that he will have you know, he'll have somebody from Blue Origin. He generally kind of stays in the background, and that's one of the things I really like about him. He's actually a very humble guy.
I got about a minute left. What is the next what's the first destination the new astronaut class would have?
The new astronaut class, their first stop is they're definitely going to fly on our commercial vehicles. They'll be ready by the time they finish their 2 years of astronaut. They're not going to be selected to come to work until 2017. And that's the first year we're going to fly our commercial crew vehicles. So they will be among the first to fly on those. But their next stop is actually on Orion, going to lunar orbit. And then eventually they will be the trailblazers. They'll be the ones that are going to do all the development we need in order to send perhaps the class after them to Mars.
Well,
some of them will stay around, and some of them may go to Mars, but they know coming in that their job is to be the trailblazers for the first Mars occupant.
Well, Administrator Bolden, thank you for taking time to be with us. And I'm glad you had an early Christmas this year.
Ari, it's a very early Christmas. You know, we announced the astronaut selection process on Monday and finished off the week with a phenomenal budget. Wow. Thanks to Congress and the president.
Now we'll be watching and keeping our fingers crossed for you. Thank you very much. Have a happy New Year and a happy holiday.
Thank you very much. Same to you.
Charles Bolden, and heading up NASA Administrator. One more thing before we go. We bid a teary farewell to our production assistant, Becky Fogel, who was leaving for the wide open spaces of Texas. Behind the scenes, Becky's creative mind and endless energy has punctuated many of these programs that you listen to. We're going to miss her contribution and her boundless sense of humor. Happy trails to you, Becky. Charles Berquist is our director. Our senior producer is Christopher Intagliata. Alexa Lim is our associate producer, our SciArts producer, Annie Minoff. Luke Raskin, our video producer. Our production assistant is Becky Fogel. Rich Kim is our technical director. Sarah Fishman, our engineer at the controls here at the studios of our production partners, the City University of New York. Before the year is over, I want to thank all of you who donated to Science Friday. This year, we produced 104 hours of radio, 25 videos, 30 educational pieces, 120 web articles, lots of other cool stuff, not too shabby to our staff. So a big thank you from all of us here at Science Friday. We could not have done it without you, and we're looking forward to making more cool stuff in 2016, which also happens to be our 25th anniversary. So look for some special stuff coming up. Have a great holiday. Merry Christmas. We'll see you next week with a special Christmas Day show. Yeah, we'll be on Christmas Day on Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow in New York.